custodians of the planet, acknowledge and pays respect to the past, present, and future traditional custodians and elders of this nation, and the continuation of cultural, spiritual, and educational practices of Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander peoples. You are with Custodians of the Planet. I'm Denise Yildiz. Custodians of the Planet brings consciousness to planetary challenges and looks at different perspectives regarding the tensions and harmony of human activities in a changing climate.
Music is the ultimate language that brings people together, transcending borders and culture with its melodic magic. It is a language that speaks to our souls, helping us to connect with loved ones, express our deepest sorrows, shed tears of joy, bust out dance moves, and ride a roller coaster of emotions. And today, we have an inspiring band from a small town in Western Australia. Formidable Vegetable has harnessed the power of this universal language to communicate sustainable living. As someone who is always on the lookout for creative ways to spread the word about the climate crisis and sustainability, I couldn't be more thrilled to introduce you Charlie McGee from Formidable Vegetable. Charlie, welcome to Custodians of the Planet.
Hey, it's great to be here.
I'm absolutely thrilled to dive into your musical journey and learn more about how you have carved your path in the world of sustainability-driven music. Take us to the beginning. How did it all start? How did you find yourself on this musical adventure?
Oh, pretty randomly, actually. Well, yeah, random in some ways. I never expected to be fronting a permaculture-themed electronic dance band in my wildest dreams. But I guess as far as permaculture goes, I was exposed to it from a young age because I grew up in an off-grid mud brick shack in the bush that my dad built. And he wanted to kind of do the self-sufficient alternative living, you know, healthy lifestyle thing for us kids. And he also didn't have a lot of money. So thankfully, those two things went hand in hand. So I grew up with him sort of building our house, but also this shed that we lived in and growing gardens and raising chickens and composting toilets and all sorts of things like that that most other kids would never have really experienced. But I just thought it was normal at the time. And I remember flipping through permaculture textbooks on his kitchen bench, you know, just that were lying around and looking at the pictures. And I was really into my chickens. I had 30 chickens and they all had names and I loved them. They were like, wow. They were like my TV. I had chicken TV. I didn't have an actual TV. So I just come home from school and go and play with the chickens. And so I remember flipping through this book and seeing all these diagrams and illustrations of different kinds of chicken yards that you could build, going into orchards and gardens and like compost systems. And I was like, ooh, what's all this? This is like advanced chickenry. And I just remember being really intrigued. I didn't think much about the text. I just liked the pictures. It was only, you know, it was years later when I moved to the city and started living in normal society, you could call it, when I just thought, hang on a minute. I didn't grow up like this. This is a bit different, and maybe I'm not quite as normal as I thought, and maybe I actually want to be a weirdo because some of this sucks. Like I furnished my sister's house entirely from junk that I picked up on the side of the road. There was, you know, leather couches and flat screen TVs, which, you know, which was modern back then, and like stereos and lamps, like absolutely everything, which people had thrown out. And I was like, why would you throw this stuff out? You know, we'd grown up in a shed that was built entirely out of recycled materials. And it was only after that that I started thinking, wow, there's something desperately wrong with the world. And it took me back to permaculture, which just this word started ringing in my mind of like, I should find out more about this permaculture thing. Like maybe there's more to it. And I went off and studied a course, permaculture design course in New South Wales. And then through that, combining with my existing experience of playing music. I'd been playing in bands for a few years just as a drummer in, you know, rock bands and folk bands. And I kind of just joined the two together after a strange series of events and created a permaculture band called Formidable Vegetables. So that that took us on the road for about 10 years and here I am now. Long story short.
That's really cool. And when did you start playing an instrument? Is that also a childhood thing or you picked up later on?
Yeah, my parents are both musos and my mum actually started singing. She became a jazz singer at the age of 40 when her friends pushed her into it because they said, your voice is too good to keep to yourself. Get out there and sing. And so she went, oh, okay. Started learning how to sing jazz. And my dad is a wind instrument player. He plays anything you blow into. And so they were always playing music and were in bands when I was growing up. And I got piano lessons when I was 7 and I hated learning, you know, I hated doing anything that they told me to do, but I just wanted to compose stuff. So I wouldn't bother reading, you know, Hot Cross Buns or Twinkle Little Star, whatever it was that they were trying to get me to learn and learn how to read music theory and stuff. I just started experimenting and making up my own songs. And it came in handy actually, because I'm still recycling them from when I was 7.
It sounds like you have a really cool parent. Just like, so it's such a dreamy.
Yeah, they're
childhood.
Pretty cool. It's hard when you've got cool parents because there's nothing to rebel against. When I got to be a teenager, it was really hard. I was like, oh, you guys aren't daggy enough. Like, come on, give me something to rebel against here. So it's like, yeah, it was a challenge. I found some things though.
Such a free spirit. I really like that. Band name is catchy as your tunes. How did the Formidable Vegetable come about and what does it represent for you?
Well, the band name is even more random than the band. It happened as we were getting on stage for our first gig and I'm still not quite sure what it means, to be honest. It was a bit of an accident, actually. So after I finished my permaculture course and written an album based on the 12 permaculture principles, which is admittedly one of the nerdiest things a musician has ever done. I had this album that was almost ready to put out and I was like, who's going to listen to this? Like, I don't have an audience. I don't have a target market. I don't even have a band. And so I just kind of had this album and I was like, what am I going to do with it? And I was playing in another band at the time called Ensemble Formidable, or Ensemble Formidable, if you wanted to sound French. That sounded more Italian for some reason. But anyway, we were booked to play at this solar eclipse festival in Cairns, far north Queensland, which is where I am now. And there were 10 of us. So it was quite a lot of people to wrangle. And so we managed to organize ourselves so that we could be at the festival on the day of the gig. And some people could stay and some people had to go. But we could all be there for one day to play this show that we'd been booked for. And I was one of the ones who wanted to come and stay for the whole festival and hang out and experience it and have a holiday up here, because why not? And so I got there, you know, a week early and I was like, right, going to go to the Eclipse Festival. I'll sort it out. I'll suss everything before the band comes, make sure it's all sweet. I talked to the organizer. I said, okay, so we're all good for our gig. Like, we're playing, you know, when are we playing again? And he said, oh, so you're playing on the first night on the main stage, headline act, opening for the whole festival. I was like, great. I was like, hang on a minute. I called the band. I was like, did he say we were playing on the first night? And they're like, no, he said we're playing on the second night. That's when we're all booked to come over. And I was like, oh, crap. Well, this guy's just said, and I said, hang on, we've got a problem. You said we're playing on the second night. We've got 10 people with flights to Cairns to play on this night. They can only be there for one night. But what are we going to? He's like, no, I booked you for the first night. You're the opening act. What do you mean? Can't they change their flights? And I said, no, because it's, you know, going to be about $7,000 in flights to change. And he said, oh, no, oh, this is terrible. What are we going to do? And he said, well, I guess we'll just have to put you on the second night then, because if that's the only time you're going to be there. But what are we going to do on the first night? And I just thought fast and I was like, well, I've got a ukulele and some songs about permaculture. What if I do that? And he's like, yep, great, do that. And so my role was to promote the gig that we were supposed to be doing on the first night with me and my ukulele without a 10-piece band. And so I got there and I was just, I didn't know what I was doing, because all I had literally was a ukulele and some songs about permaculture and this half-baked album that I managed to get the semi-finished recordings of and cobble into this electronic dance music beat that could somehow be enjoyable for thousands of electronic music lovers. And we just got on stage and just I dragged a bunch of random musicians that I found camped around the festival and said, come and play with me at this time, no time to explain. And they're like, okay. And as we were getting on stage, the MC said, all right, so what are you guys called? And I was like, oh, shit, we don't even have a name. And I just thought, well, okay, I'm trying to tell people about my other band. So I said, Formidable Vegetable. And we're Formidable Vegetable Sound System is what came out. And it stuck because we had a great gig. And afterwards, everyone was like, who was that Formidable Vegetable band? Like, well, that was great. And we got booked for a world tour as soon as we got off stage. And that was how it all began.
Wow. That sounds really spontaneous, yeah, but almost planned by life. It's just like, this is your path.
Well, you know, and then like the moon went in front of the sun and there was a solar eclipse. And then, you know, that was a whole other part of the randomness. But that was the part of the plan, but actually.
That's quite a scene. Your band is known for its fun and creative tunes. What inspires your songwriting? Or in other words, what sparks your creativity and drives you to address environmental issues through music?
Well, the things that inspire me are usually really nerdy, complex, science-y or economics-y or politics-y or just anything nerdy and cool. But not everyone finds nerdy things cool. So the thing that inspires the songs, I think, is that sense of bringing fun to the nerdy and cool, because, you know, not everyone can unpack or understand these really complex topics, and a lot of the time I can't either. So part of the fun is to try and turn these complex things into something digestible that I can remember or understand, and then bring that to an audience as well. I think when I was doing my permaculture course, we were learning about pattern languages and pattern recognition and how our brains are actually wired to recognize patterns more than just, you know, raw data and text and things like that. And that's how I started writing music about permaculture, because I was like, well, music's a pattern. What if I can use that to remember this permaculture stuff that I'm trying to learn? And that's what inspired the first album. But yeah, since then I've kind of delved into a few other areas and tried to use fun songs to actually create these easily memorable mnemonics, I guess, you know, the little tools that you use to just remember things, like anything from your shopping list to an exam that you're cramming for or something. And I don't think many people in popular music anyway use music for that. So I'm kind of keen on exploring that edge of music. And I'm really lucky to be, you know, in a band with a lot of other nerdy musicians like Mal Webb, who also do that kind of stuff. So we really kind of bounce off each other and play around with ideas and just get really nerdy, but then try and make it accessible. So it's a bit of a balance, but yeah, that's part of the fun.
Yeah, that sounds really cool. And even when I was drafting these questions and listening to your music, and while I was cycling back home, and, you know, I was just like singing the songs. It's just like in the back of my mind. They're really quite catchy.
Yeah, it's working.
It's definitely working. Have you ever, I'm just curious, have you ever got interested in how animals or plants communicate with each other? It's in the like modern human life, because there's a language between them too. And like, do you have curiosity or do you have any drive to kind of get to know them or engage with them and try to integrate into your music?
Oh, for sure. I mean, like the last few years, I've just become more and more obsessed with microbes. And I've just started reading this book at the moment about the soil food web and soil microbes. And, you know, that idea that plants communicate underground through the mycelial web, through fungi, and they send chemical signals to each other and share food and sugars and distribute messages through this vast network underground. And, you know, like just that by itself is incredible. But yeah, I see, you know, music and songs as being that for humans, or, you know, for more than humans as well. And so, yeah, I'm definitely intrigued by different kind of beyond human communication, and not in some kind of esoteric out there way, but in like the real, you know, researched biological, ecological way that people are discovering is actually happening. And, you know, obviously people have known that it's been happening for years, and some people have been more tuned into that. And of course, a lot of indigenous cultures are like, yeah, of course. But, you know, to be able to take that knowledge and to try and sort of bring that into an accessible form that people who don't necessarily understand that or might be hearing it for the first time, that's like, whoa, really? Like, yeah, that's really cool.
What you said reminded me of an exhibition I encountered either last year or the year before. Can't really remember. Anyway, in this exhibition, all the fungi were connected to produce a particular sound bit. As they communicated with each other, a beautiful melody emerged. It was amazing. I'm not familiar with the exact technical details, but I had a chance to speak with a technician or the person in charge there. And he said that the fungi had been brought from Sydney, so they had to be transported by flying them over to Hobart. And interestingly, when they initially arrived, the fungi didn't communicate with each other. So there was this absolute silence. It seemed like they were distressed or experiencing some kind of unease, and which in turn caused huge stress for the people who were, you know, thought about this idea. It was an entire experience.
I remember once years ago watching this documentary, actually reading a book called The Secret Life of Plants. And it was written in the 70s, you know, it's going back ages, but it talked about that, about plant communication and you know, plant emotions and plant sentience. And I just remember having this moment when, you know, reading about when they did an experiment with just these house plants. I don't know what they were. They were mimosa, the sensitive plants. So the ones when you touch them, they wilt. So they have, you know, they're extra sensitive. And they did this experiment in a lab with boiling water and shrimp, you know, these little tiny, tiny krill type shrimp, like really small animals that you wouldn't think would, you know, from a human perspective anyway, were of little consequence. Not that anything's of little consequence, but they did this experiment where they had some boiling water, and then at a random moment, these jug of shrimp would be tipped into the boiling water and killed. And in the other room, behind a glass panel, not looking at the shrimp or even, you know, like just behind in another room, they had these plants hooked up to these electrodes to measure their plant impulses. And the scientists left the building. They went down the street and had some dinner so that they wouldn't interfere with the experiment. And then at a random time on a random timer, these shrimp went into the water and died, and the plant in the other room went like freaked out. Like it picked up the fact that another living creature was being killed in the room next to it, and this impulse started to go. And in that moment, I remember I just was like, what? Like mind blown. Like I went outside and I looked around at all the plants. I was just like, hello? So that was a pretty mind-bending moment. But you know, after that, it kind of becomes obvious. It's like, well, yes, actually we're connected in a living world that is full of life, and we're not the only ones on it. And that's something that, you know, it shouldn't be mind-blowing, but like the fact that our Western modern culture has separated us so much from this ecological just milieu around us, you know, is kind of, that's the mind-blowing part. It's like, how did we get here? You know, we should be there with all of that, but somehow we're separate and we're, you know, other than. And even though even this concept of us and them is kind of anti-ecological in a lot of ways. So yeah, bringing that back to any way that we can communicate that we are part of something bigger than ourselves, or even more than that, that ourselves are that bigger thing. It's not that we're a part or not a part, it's we are that. Like, we are nature, we are the biosphere. You know, that's a pretty big concept to get across. And a few years ago, you would have been laughed out of the room and been called a hippie, or, you know, just some woo-woo crazy person. But slowly changing. Yeah, the narrative slowly and faster than you might imagine, because science is backing it up. And, of course, we have to believe science. So, you know, whatever works.
Yeah. I mean, and you say fast enough, but also not enough. It's not fast enough as well, considering the ecological crisis where we're in. Who knows?
Who knows? It'll happen when it needs to happen, and we'll find out either way, however it happens.
Music delivers important messages. How do you think using music as a medium helps you communicate low-impact lifestyle? For example, the significance of managing waste, the splendor of gardens, or even the wonders of kimchi.
Look, I think music is just the ultimate Trojan horse. You know, it just gets in where other things can't get in. It just cuts through between the lines, no matter who it is. You know, if I was to get up on a soapbox and start preaching about permaculture, you know, half the room might just walk out and be like, who is this guy? This is boring, or they'd fall asleep or something. But you put a beat to it and a melody to it, and it gets to the emotional side. It gets to something like really fundamental in us. And, you know, I think music is one of the first forms of communication that we had, you know, in whatever sort of evolutionary process we went to. You know, we started out making grunts or hitting things in a rhythm or working with the patterns in nature. I mean, you just have to listen to the crickets outside to hear that music is all around us, and music is a natural part of life. And so I think as a tool, you know, it's so powerful. And a lot of big business advertising types know this, and that's why music, you know, musicians get paid a lot of money to advertise products. But what it's not used for as much is to actually communicate knowledge and educate. Yeah, I think that's something that we really could be focusing more on in schools, you know, right through the board. I mean, we're taught ABC and, you know, nursery rhymes and things when we're in kindergarten. But then after that, it's like, what happened to that? Like, that was cool. Like, keep doing it.
Daikon radish with a cabbage finely diced. Then I chop a little chili with the garlic and the ginger to crank it up with spice. Then add saltiness, sweetly caress it to give it a good massage. Then when I see that water rise, I stuff it inside a jar. Kimchi, so good for me. Fermenty probiotic flavor jamboree.
Wonder why we don't use it in a way that could be more beneficial, or, you know, create this collective awareness around us.
Well, I mean, I think a lot of people do, but it's different for different people. You know, some people do sound healing, and that's just frequency, right? I mean, everything's frequency. You know, other people use it in like a political sense or for different reasons, but I think fundamentally there's something really universal about it, and something that everyone can witness or experience, you know, maybe in a way that's beyond words. I mean, a lot of music is beyond words, but there's different kinds of music too, and it depends on, you know, the frequency and the speed and the tempo and the timbre and all of that. I'm not a music genius or whiz like Mal or, you know, a bunch of our other band members, but I've definitely felt the power of music before and, you know, seen the results of it as well.
I've been experimenting with music, which actually became a pandemic hobby during the lockdown. This was back in Sydney. My housemates at that time encouraged me to buy a tractor or a simple deck, because there's always a soundtrack playing in the background of my life and I'm a music enthusiast. So I've been DJing at parties and also started to develop this notion of activist DJing or dancing with a purpose. Although I have only done this a few times. So it involves electronic music with important messages embedded. In one of my sets, I edited Greta Thunberg's speech and it was very powerful. I don't think I would achieve the same result by simply reading her speech or playing the recording. But when it's embedded in music, there is something performative about it, creating a unique vibe.
Yeah, and, you know, Indigenous cultures have practiced this for thousands of millennia. You know, the dancing and singing as a group and as a collective rather than as an individual, you know, like I'm the singer and you all listen. It's like a participatory thing, right? It's a cultural ceremony. And, you know, they've used it to teach knowledge and perform ceremonial rites and invoke things, you know, that we in the Western world don't even have language for and can't even comprehend. But, you know, I think a lot of people, even in the Western world, do experience that and can experience that. I was just thinking today, I was just watching, I was at a waterfall and I was watching the water come over this waterfall with such intensity and just, you know, create this massive whirlpool and like bubbles and exploding into the bottom. And, you know, if I stood under it, I'd be pummeled. Like the weight of the water was so strong and it was flowing so fast. And then it would do this vortex around the pool and then it went over another waterfall and it went down to a lower bit. And then it kind of calmed down a bit and then it became a little bit more of an eddy and a babbling brook. And then it evened right out and it became almost still. And I went down to the bottom. I was like, wait, how can this water down here that was so raging up there be almost still? And it's the same water, but it's going through all these movements that make it do these different dances and then give it this different embodiment, you know, to perform different functions. You know, it's weathering the rock in different ways. It's shaping the ecosystem. It's, you know, evaporating and coming back down as rain. It's like, it's the same energy, but it's taking all these different forms and then literally terraforming the world around us. And I was talking to my friend and I was like, isn't that amazing that water can do this? And I said, imagine if people could do that too. And she said, well, they can. And she told me about this experience that she had on a dance floor in Turkey during the solar eclipse festival there to this electronic music. And there was, there'd just been a solar eclipse and everyone from all over the world was dancing. And she said the dance floor was so packed that you couldn't fit any more people. It was like shoulder to shoulder. There was no room, but everyone was doing the same movements and fully, you know, moving their limbs and arms and bodies, but completely in alignment because that's all they could do because there wasn't room to do your own thing. And she said the other thing that was really strange was that everyone standing around her was from a different country. There were people from African countries and from Russia and from, you know, Bulgaria. And she said they were all communicating. They were all speaking and understanding each other. And she just said it was a really bizarre experience to see this, you know, tens of thousands of people strong dance floor moving in this synchronized way and also communicating at the same time. It's, you know, I really do think it's possible. And we've experienced some things like that. I've tried to recreate that at some of our gigs where we kind of facilitate, a big circle with the crowd and then we get them to do these synchronized movements. And you just see the crowd come alive and people who might not even have come with anybody or felt a connection to people. You know, I had some feedback once from a guy who was in the crowd saying, oh, look, I came to your gig and I really wasn't feeling it. I was having a bit of a bad day and I didn't really want to talk to anyone, but I wanted to see you play. And then you did that thing where you got everyone to join hands and make a circle. And as soon as I joined hands with the person next to me, I just I just came alive. Like, I just felt so connected. And then I had the best time of my life, and we were dancing together and moving. And it was so beautiful to hear from this guy who just felt like really disconnected beforehand. And then suddenly you bring people together and it creates community. And community is ecology. And that's life. You know, that's everything around us. So, yeah, you know, my big challenge in life is to try and create more of those moments where we can actually, you know, we're singing about ecology and permaculture and growing things and plants and animals and people and communities, but to actually somehow synthesize that on a dance floor is like my ultimate goal. And we've done it, we've like touched on it a few times, but I'm just really excited to kind of learn more ways to do that and, yeah, see what happens.
I think you and the band do that beautifully, because I had the pleasure of experiencing your performance at the Pangaea Festival in Tassie. And I've never imagined I would find myself dancing to a song about Dunnies, like my dad, Dunny doesn't flash. how do you blend these elements and keep your audience growing while raising awareness?
Oh, look, I you know what? I've got no idea. I always spin out when we sing the Dunny song, which is a, it was written as a kid's song, right? Like a lot of our music is aimed at kids, but you know, a lot of people at festivals kind of have this childlike thing about them. So, you know, they kind of are kids. And I think maybe that element of fun and just keeping it lighthearted, and also a banging beat. You know, we got our tracks produced by Spoonbill, who's an amazing world-class producer from Melbourne, and he just makes everything sound amazing. So having that, you know, making sure that the sound is incredible and the bass gets people and the beat kind of gets people up, I think helps. You could sing about anything and have a cranking beat and then you get people moving. So that's really important. But yeah, again, I think just no matter what it's about, like just silliness. I think the world needs more silliness as well. You know, people are really serious all the time, and then we get up there, we're like, hey, everybody, let's ferment cabbage and build composting toilets. And I don't know. It seems to work sometimes. There seems to be more kimchi in the world. We wrote the kimchi, so I don't know if that's, you know, I'm not taking any credit or anything, but it's just interesting, right?
Yeah, I think things are just, life is just so serious. And as you said, we only get to know, like, an experience and in, like, interact with those songs in the kindergarten, and then you're like, just jump into the real life and just get serious. So it's, we definitely lose that fun bit.
You know, when it comes to ecological stuff, I think a lot of us are still in kindergarten. So I think maybe we need kindergarten music to reconnect to the ecological side of you know, connecting with our living world. You know, how else to do that but with fun? Like if you come at it from an angle of like, everyone, climate change is here and it's going to take us all out and we have to do something or you're going to pay, and you know, people would just be like, no, I haven't got time for this. Like, this is too hard or scary or this guy's crazy or whatever. You know, it's like, you just got to come at it. Like, who is it that said, I don't want to join your revolution if I can't dance? Like, I vibe with her, because, you know, that's where we're coming from. It's like, if it's too serious, and, you know, I'm serious. Like, I think about this stuff all the time, and I get into these really serious, like cerebral, like, oh, what can I do? You know, this has got to have a logical solution and I have to do something and I'm an adult and I'm responsible, and I get caught up in this just as much as anyone else. So for me, I need this outlet of silliness and fun, which, you know, I can give, you know, in a crowd of people, you know, together, for my own mental well-being and sanity, you know, just like, we need to go in a little bit insane to stay sane in this day and age, I think.
Yeah, I that totally resonates with me. And just a mini note here, because we have an international audience, Dunny is a term used in Australia and maybe in New Zealand, I don't know, but that referred a toilet.
Oh yeah,
sorry. So in this context, it's a compostable toilet.
Yes, yeah, sorry, I forget to explain that, because we haven't toured internationally for about 5 years, but one of my favorite moments was playing at Glastonbury Festival in the UK, and in England they don't really know what a dunny is, but we had the whole crowd fist pumping with their ciders singing, "My dad's dunny doesn't flush." It's like, didn't know what a dunny was, but I guess they, you know, got it after singing it enough times. And in America, they're just like, "Dunny? What's a dunny?" Bring it back to dunny.
That's really cool. You played it in Glastonbury. You just put it like as a, like a little side note, but that's amazing. Just to be reminded.
Glastonbury is awesome. We played it 3 times, and it was amazing. And it's beyond amazing. It's a kind of incomprehensible. It's about 10 festivals in one. There's just so many people you can't even fathom it. We were actually going to go back to play it in 2019, but I made the call to stop flying. And so I actually had to call up Glastonbury and say, really sorry, but we're not going to come and play at your festival. So we turned down an offer to play at Glastonbury.
Really?
And apparently no band has ever done that before. So we got more publicity doing that than we would have actually playing at Glastonbury, because the BBC got on, like, "What? You turned down Glastonbury? This is preposterous. Why did you do that?" I was like, "Well, you know, we sing about climate change and then we're getting on planes and flying around the world. It's kind of ironic, don't you think?" And so, yeah, we didn't get to play that year, but we had played a few years before that. And yeah, so then, I mean, after that, it went online anyway for COVID, so we got to play anyway. It's just on Zoom.
Yeah, wow. I mean, it's quite tricky, you know, when you're trying to go and share, you want to share your music, and but then you want to make sure it aligns with your values and your lifestyle. So just that trade-off is a tricky one. Mm.
It is. It's a really tricky one, and I guess, you know, I have friends who do permaculture, but they don't want to use the word permaculture because they're like, "Oh, we're not permaculture. We're not good enough to be permaculture. You know, permaculture is this really high ethical framework that we couldn't possibly." And I'm like, "You guys are doing permaculture. Like, what are you talking about?" But I kind of understand where they're coming from, because permaculture isn't, I mean, permaculture is not one thing. It's more of a framework to start changing the way that we see the world. And it's 3 things, actually. It's ecological literacy, so understanding that we live in an ecology and how that works. And ethics and principles are the kind of key central part, you know, earth care, people care, and fair share. And then all these principles for design. And design is the part where you put pen to paper and you actually try to create functioning ecological systems with that base of ethics and principles. And so in some ways, you know, it sounds really big and like, whoa, how can we ever achieve that? But on the other side, you know, you've just got to try, and you've got to start somewhere. Mm. And it's not about being perfect. You know, you can't ever hope to be perfect. And I think a lot of people now are getting stuck, and myself included sometimes, on doing things perfectly. And, oh my God, there's so many inequality, you know, social justice issues that we have to get right. And if we're not perfect, then I'm going to get cancelled, or I'm going to like totally ruin someone's life or whatever. But if you just sit back and don't try, then you're never going to be perfect. And the fact is, we're never going to be perfect, full stop. We're going to make mistakes. We're going to stuff up. But if we just keep taking the steps, hopefully in the right direction, small and slow, you know, not big and like, let's save the world. That's something else I don't believe in. No one can save the world. Newsflash.
No.
And if you think you can, then you better check your Messiah complex. But communities, I think communities and collectives can together respond to problems and, you know, predicaments that we're in a way that can, you know, create more sustainable and regenerative systems. I think that's the only way it can happen, is if people just observe and interact, which is the first principle of permaculture, and work together, integrate rather than segregate, to create small and slow solutions. And it's counterintuitive in some ways, because on one hand we're getting bombarded with this, we've got this crisis coming at us left, right, and center, so we need to fix things fast. And it's like, you know, then you get the Silicon Valley mentality of move fast and break things. But all that does is move fast and break things. It's like, why don't we move slow and fix things? You know, it's not going to be overnight. You know, yes, stuff's going to get broken, but it's, you know, it's already kind of on the way. It's like, why don't we just do what we can where we are using what we've got? And yeah, I totally went off on a tangent there. I have no idea what the question was initially, but there you go.
Yeah, we don't have a word to describe this particular experience and state of mind, but it is a common happening, I guess, among individuals who are conscious about the state of the planet, and we try to carry the weight on our shoulders and strive to do everything right. For instance, I visit my family once a year, so I have to fly back to Europe, and it holds a great significance for all of us because we are distant geographically. And it's just a once a year, it's kind of a ritual. However, every time I'm on a plane for a 30-hour journey, I can't help but feel anxious, you know, because the plastic wrapped meals and the sight of the plane's engines, it just makes me feel so uncomfortable. And throughout the trip, I try to remind myself to let go, because it takes a toll on my mental well-being. And it is hard to do everything right.
Yeah, and, you know, I guess it's just a matter of, like, weighing up the pros and cons. You know, for me, traveling overseas for 7 months of the year, you know, I was flying so much. And I just got to a point where I was like, is this achieving what I'm hoping to achieve? Like, is my contribution to the solution outweighing my, you know, contribution to the problem? And for me, you know, after reading the climate report 1.5 degrees and the focus on fossil fuels and, you know, carbon and all that, I was like, well, no. So I'm going to do something about it. But, you know, in the last few months, I've had to break it a few times, and I didn't fly for 4 years, and it really, you know, had a big impact on the band and on my career, if you want to put it that way. But, you know, I was in my ethics and my integrity, but arguably I wasn't contributing as much as I could have been by getting the message out, or, you know, connecting people at gigs. I don't know. Like, there's no way of knowing, you know, because how could I have done anything different? But it was just an interesting reflection to kind of spend 4 years staying at home. And, you know, most of that was COVID, so, you know, everyone was staying at home. So it was pretty good timing, really. But then just reflecting on, well, is this the most effective use of my time? Like, I can sing these songs and I can play, you know, in this band. Can everyone do that? Probably not. Like, I have a unique opportunity here. How can I use that in a sustainable way that's not, you know, going to be just blowing things up or destroying stuff in my way? But yeah, it's a hard one. It's a constant balance. And, you know, there's always going to be people being like, oh, you got in a plane. Oh, your ukulele's got plastic strings. Oh, you know, that you're going to get that no matter what you do. And you just have to pick and choose. That's the thing. I'm really bad at picking and choosing. I tend to, like, listen to all of the negative stuff, and I'm like, oh, God, they're right. I'm a terrible person, and, like, flagellate myself. But I've just got to learn to get over that, basically, and realize that, you know, nothing's ever going to be perfect, and yet everything is always perfect, you know, at the same time. It's all like holding those two things at once. And it's so hard to do in this time when there is so much that isn't perfect. And you're like, but I want to change things. And sometimes, you know, I've done a lot of meditation over the years, and I've done a 10-day Vipassana course sort of every couple of years or so.
I'm just about to do one.
Oh, it's the best thing I've ever done. And
really?
In that, they just teach you to observe. They say, just observe. Whatever happens, it might be terrible. Doesn't matter. Just observe. And then you observe, and it's like, oh, God, this is terrible. And it's like, yep, just keep observing. You can't do anything about it. It's terrible. Observe terribleness. And it's like, oh, I don't want to observe. It's like, you don't have a choice. And then suddenly it's like, oh, wait, things aren't as, aren't that terrible anymore. It's like, oh, actually, I feel pretty good. Oh, this is great. They're like, yep, yep, this is great. Just observe. And you're like, oh, this is awesome. Yeah, woo, yeah, enlightenment, yay. And then they're like, yep, just observe. Don't get happy about it because it's going to change. And it's one of the hardest things I've ever done, but one of the most rewarding. And oh, that's awesome that you're going to do one. I think, yeah, I think you get a lot out of it.
Yeah, I must admit I feel a mix of excitement and nervousness about it. Over time, I've come to realize that cultivating a calm state of mind and embracing a sustainable lifestyle often involves slowing down. And my current life is quite fast-paced and life seems to be constantly shouting at me and urging me to go, 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 go. However, when we intentionally step back from that hustle and bustle, we can create space to observe, reflect, and truly notice things around us, because I am more consumptive when things are rushed. You know, I'm eating more outside, I buy more things just to keep me going. I personally find it difficult to reflect on things when life is busy and demanding most of my time.
Yeah, that's a hard one too. Like, that is easier said than done. You know, one of the permaculture principles, small and slow solutions. And I always say that that's my favorite principle, but it's the one that I can never get right. Because I'm so excitable naturally. So I tend to get hyped up about things. I'm like, yeah, I'm going to do everything. And then it's like, oh, then you hit a wall and burn out. It's like, well, that wasn't sustainable. But yeah, I think the small and slow is where it's at. You know, that's where we've got to get to. Because globally, you know, we're hitting all these limits to growth. And I mean, the Limits to Growth report was written in what, the 1970s, and they still were like, nope, let's keep growing the economy and growing, you know, resource extraction and chemical use and everything. But it's coming to a point now where we can't do that anymore for much longer. I mean, we might be able to do it for a little bit longer, but at what peril to everything? And yeah, like, the only solution, one, you know, I hesitate to say the only solution, because I think there's always many solutions, but one of the key solutions is to slow down and use less. And that's the thing that is hardly ever talked about in, you know, government or, you know, these big UN sort of strategy, like even the sustainable development goals, which I think are great. You know, most of them are awesome, but there's one that's like sustainable growth. And it's like, well, and it's got this, you know, graph going up as if the economy can always grow. It's like, that doesn't really fit in with all these other things that you're trying to do. Yeah. So, you know, nobody wants to acknowledge that, and nobody wants to talk about it, because the entire, the whole of this Western capitalist culture is based on growth. And it's like, that's the thing you can't challenge, but that's the thing we have to challenge. And even personally, you know, I have to reprogram myself constantly to stop thinking about, oh, I've got to get bigger, better, faster, stronger. You know, it's like, hang on, maybe I just need to be bored for a while. Maybe I just need to chill out. Maybe I just need to go grow some veggies in the garden, you know, like do the stuff that I sing about. And yeah, that's the ultimate goal, I think.
Yeah. One thing I noticed about you and the way you talk about permaculture and its principles sound like they go beyond simply growing veggies or playing in a soil-based playground. It sounds like it embodies a philosophy that can be applied to all aspects of life. Do you agree with that?
Yeah, it's a philosophy, but
is it a new religion?
No, it's not. It's permaculture is not a cult. If anybody tries to make it a cult, tell them they don't know what they're talking about. That was something my teacher, Robin Francis from Janbung Gardens, where I did my course, said. She said, there's no dogma in permaculture. If anyone ever tries to tell you that that's not permaculture or this is not permaculture, tell them they're full of crap. So I'm glad she said that, because there's a lot of people who are like, what? You don't have a swale? It's not permaculture. You don't have a herb spiral? No, it's definitely a way of thinking, but I think more than that, it's a way of practicing. So, like meditation, you know, if you're not, if you're just talking about it and not doing it, well, Is that permaculture? I don't know. I don't think so. But there's many ways to do it as well. You know, it took me a while to realize that I didn't have to actually have a vegetable garden to do permaculture. A lot of people think permaculture is all about veggie gardening or composting or growing food, but it's not even about that. It's literally those three things that I mentioned before: ecological literacy, ethics and principles, and design. And that can be applied to social systems, community governance, you know, banking, finance, food production, of course, and gardening. But as you know, as long as it comes back to the ecological, which is all of life, you know, it doesn't have to be farming or land care, but it encompasses everything. So it's pretty broad. But I think if we're not practicing in some way, and even music, you know, I've realized that playing music about permaculture is part of the design process and part of that ecological thinking, because music brings people together, and that's sort of been my design process for the last few years. And I'm in a really lucky position now where my partner and I have just bought some land and we're building a straw bale house. And so we get to have a garden and we get to build our own house and we get to actually experience the land-based stuff, which I've been craving, like I guess a lot of people do. And but in community as well. So we're on a community, you know, we live with 18 other families and people there, and there's lots of visitors, and you know, we want to teach courses and actually sink into the local, the bioregional side of it, which is really exciting. You know, it's an evolution, and it's started out kind of out there and it's coming back in, which is nice.
That sounds dreamy. Congrats. Embarking on that journey.
Thanks. Yeah, it is.
Your music undoubtedly is a creative way of spreading awareness, but what would be your ultimate dream or goal in terms of inspiring real change?
Well, I hope music will be part of it always in some way, but maybe not in the global touring. I mean, we already have stopped touring internationally, but you know, the constantly traveling sort of touring life, and also the kind of musician audience separation as well. Like I've always been uncomfortable with that idea of the musician or the band as this sort of, I don't know, unattainable sort of godlike entity. You know, you go to a rock concert and people treat musos like gods. They're like, oh my God, you guys are amazing. I can't possibly be like you. But what I want to get from this is to actually be like, no, like actually all of us can do this. You know, we can do this, and I couldn't be doing this without you, and you couldn't be doing you without me. And so, you know, to somehow keep bringing that message into the world somehow. But for me, I think that comes down to actually being involved in a community and in a bioregion. And you know, traveling's become really hard. Like we can hardly afford to travel to tour anymore. And so I'm looking at different options, you know, into the future of like, well, how do we sustain ourselves and our creativity in a more local bioregional setting? So I'm thinking of like school shows and, you know, kids concerts and just touring the communities within 100K radius of where we live, and then being involved in where we live and creating other creative hubs or groups or projects with the people that we live with, and just really, really kind of focusing on that relocalization, but with a global intention to kind of replicate that model. So, yeah, it's interesting times, but I've just become a board member of Permaculture Australia, which is the national peak body, and that's pretty exciting because they want to move into being like a national representative of permaculture that we can, you know, bring to the world and really kind of grow the movement, and also to go the other way and support local groups doing amazing things on the land, you know, all over the country. So yeah, there's plenty of options, but I think at the end of the day, you know, creativity prevails, and you always come up with something. Eventually, something will happen.
Yeah, just to keep the creativity going, I guess.
Can't stop it.
True. I mean, musicians, all artists or creatives do experience this block sometimes, but maybe that's, I don't want to get into too much detail, but I guess as long as one is receptive and attuned, I think creativity is always there. Yeah.
I think that's true. And I think creativity is something that anyone can have and everyone does have. But exactly what you just said, I think it's about being receptive and letting creativity come to you. I think nature is creative. The world is creative. The living web of life is creative, and we are a part of that. So I think we can all be creative, and we're all going to have to be more creative with our solutions and our thinking because the structures that we're used to are changing, you know, very quickly. So it's scary in some ways, but it's exciting in others because it's going to force us to be more creative. And that might be in an artistic way, or that might be in a solutions-based problem-solving way, or like a really technological sort of way, or like whatever. Creativity comes in so many different forms. And so, you know, I think one of the biggest barriers to try and challenge is people who say, I'm not creative, I can't think creatively, I'm not a musician or an artist or whatever. It's like, well, no, you might not be one of those things, but everyone can be creative. And we just need to tap into that in whichever way makes us come alive, because, you know, creativity really is exciting and fun, and maybe that thing that sparks your interest or makes you come alive is the gateway to creativity. And when I was doing my permaculture course, I'll just leave you on this beautiful quote that a friend told me, because I was looking into all of the dark stuff about, you know, coal seam gas fracking and deforestation and ecological degradation. And I just got to this point where I was overwhelmed. I was like, oh God, like, get me off. Someone stop the world. I want to get off. And I just came out in this sort of fog of despair and said, what can I do? Like, what can I do? I'm just one person. Like, I can't do anything. And she said this quote from Howard Thurman, which is, don't ask yourself, what can I do for the world? Ask, what makes you come alive? Because what the world needs is people who've come alive. And that stuck with me. And I was like, wow, yeah, what? You mean I can play music? Because that makes me come alive. And that's exactly what I did. And it's been great. That was 10 years ago. So, you know, something worked.
That's so beautiful. I love that quote. And as a final question, because I don't want to add too much onto that quote, where can our curious listeners find you and support you and enjoy your music and performances?
Well, we're touring down the East Coast for the next 4 months. So depending on when this podcast comes out, we're on the road from June until October 2023. So between Queensland and New South Wales and South Australia and WA, we'll be somewhere. But you can check us out at formidablevegetable.com. And we're launching our new album called Microbiome, which is a bit of a fun one. So that's up on all of the streaming platforms, and download it from our website as well, or, you know, social media. We're on all the places. And if, you know, if this kind of resonates, or, you know, you want to support in any other way beyond that, we're also on Patreon, which some of you might know is a monthly donation to artists and creatives who are trying to make a living but can't always afford to tour or, you know, do things. So if you want to make a donation to Patreon, it can be like $2 a month or whatever, you know, price of a coffee, and we'll give little behind-the-scenes exclusive goodies every once in a while, and, you know, freebies when we release a thing, and free tickets to concerts, which is really fun. So, yeah, we're at patreon.com/growdoit as well.
That sounds wonderful. Charlie, thank you so much for your time. It's been such a lovely conversation. I really enjoyed it.
Oh, thanks so much, Peters. It's great to talk to you.
When I was a little kid, I liked to catch the rain. While my friends around the town let it flow right down the drain. But our tiny house in the trees had one thing that we drank. Every drop that we had saved in our rainwater tank. Because there's no such thing as waste. Only stuff in the wrong place. No, there's no such thing as waste. When we treasure every trace.
on my way to buy a bed. Saw one lying on the side of the road, so I took that one instead. And I also found a fridge, a couch, and a big old sewing machine, with the biggest pile of thrown out stuff that I had ever seen. But there's no such thing as waste. Oh no, only stuff in the wrong place. Yeah, I said there's no such thing as waste. Better save it just in case. Such thing as way, only opportunity.